When there was no practice, Luke went to team barbecues. He stretched on white lawn chairs as the Cobras crowded around grills, arguing about the best way to marinate a steak. Finch said that steaks didn't need marinade at all. None of that foo-foo pussy shit. Just eat the goddamn meat like you were meant to. Ritter said sorry. He didn't want to eat the steak straight off the cow. It meant he wasn't a fucking Neanderthal. Not that he was a pussy. And Gorman said of course Finch knew a lot about eating meat. The wives carried out bowls of potato salad and macaroni and cheese, sometimes joining in the group and jibing the men, and Luke thought, I could have a life like this. He sat by the kiddie pool, watching the Cobra's children splash, and when they climbed out, they jumped on him, their bodies slick and cold as they tried to tackle him. He pulled himself out of a dog pile and found one of the wives, Gorman's or Ritter's, he could never remember, standing over him, blocking the sun from her eyes. She was smiling. You're so good with kids, she said. Thanks, he said, embarrassed by how good that made him feel. Late after one barbecue, when the party had died down, and he sat under the fading tiki torch, finishing off his beer, he told Finch that he had been a father once, long ago.
Fucking bullshit is what it is, Finch said. She wants to get rid of your kid? You got no say in that. But say she wanted to keep it. Guess who she's hitting up for money? Guess whose ass is getting hauled off to jail if he can't pay? A man's got no rights anymore.
Luke drained his beer, watching the flame above them flicker and dance. He felt pitiful, but if a man couldn't feel pitiful late at night after drinking too much, when could he?
She left me, he said. She went to Europe and shit, and now she's fucking some Arab motherfucker.
Finch hooked an arm around his neck.
I'm sorry, brother, he said. That's some bullshit, and we both know it. I love my wife more than anything, but I'd kill her if she got rid of my baby.
His eyes bulged a little, and Luke could tell he meant it. He suddenly felt sick. He stood too fast, the ground beneath him tilting, and he felt dizzy, like when he used to put on his mother's reading glasses and run around the house. Finch refused to let him walk home and pulled him inside. His wife put sheets on the couch for him, even though Luke told her he was fine with just a blanket. He felt touched by her extra effort, until he realized that maybe she just didn't want him to puke on her couch. He hoped he wouldn't. He stretched out, feeling the bumps in the cushion, his body taut with pain. He was grateful for how much he felt everything now. The wife brought a blanket from the hall, and he closed his eyes as it fluttered on top of him. Mrs. Fincher's name was Cherry. First name like the fruit, last name like the bird. Not Sherry, she said. Everyone wants to call me Sherry. Why would I want to be named after liquor?
I went to high school with a girl named Chardonnay, Luke said.
Well, you're a baby, she said. You probably went to school with a girl named Grapefruit. She was always doing that, calling him a baby. He didn't mind it. She wouldn't tell him her age, but he figured she was around 35. Not old, but at the age where women start to think they are. If he ever got married, he decided, he would find a woman older than him. Too much pressure being the older one in the relationship. When you were the baby, a woman didn't expect much from you. She wanted to take care of you, and he felt comforted by it all, her attention and her low expectations. If an actor over 50 appeared on TV, Cherry would say, I bet you don't even know who that is. And he would shrug even if he did, because it made her laugh. He'd sit at the counter while she made her kids sandwiches, and although he never asked, she always made him one too. He wasn't attracted to her, not the way he usually was to women he chose to spend time with. She was fat. She had a too wide smile and a strong chin. She was Filipina, and she'd grown up poor in Hawaii. Luke had never even thought about there being poor people in Hawaii.
"Don't y'all just surf and roast pigs and wear grass skirts and shit?"
he asked. Sherry didn't talk to him for 2 days.
"You gotta shut off that TV and fucking go somewhere, Luke," she said later. "Paradise ain't paradise for everyone."
She'd met Finch when he was stationed at Kaneohe Bay. She'd waited tables nearby at a tourist trap called Aloha Cafe, where the menu featured items with names like Surfside Steak and Luau Lamb Chops. Finch ordered the beach bum brownies, but he kept calling them butt brownies, which made her laugh. She was 18. By the time she reached Luke's age, she had married, moved to the mainland, and birthed 3 kids. Luke liked her children, but he wondered if they were the only reason Sherry and Finch were still together. When he came over to watch a game with Finch, he studied the two of them, expecting to spot some invisible bond between them. But Finch rarely acknowledged Sherry, and she was quiet around him, as if they had parceled out space in the house, carved it up like warring countries fighting over territory. Sherry behind the kitchen counter, passing through the living room like a tourist, Finch awkward anywhere near a stove, instead sprawling across the couch. At Cobra's parties, Sherry sipped Pinot Grigio with the other wives, always seeming a bit bored. Once Luke had heard the other wives call her stuck up, and he thought about her stories about eating sugar sandwiches for dinner, how she rarely saw her parents who worked at the Dole cannery, how she'd grown up thinking that everyone knew their parents vaguely, by shadows cast in late nights, or half-remembered forehead kisses at dawn, how she'd gotten married and grown fat and still felt the need to hoard, stashing candy bars in end drawers, packing old clothes in garbage bags at the back of her closet, because what if there wasn't enough? "Poorness never left you," she told him. "It was a hunger that embedded itself into your bones. It starved you, even when you were full."
"I'm starting a new diet tomorrow," she said, unwrapping a Reese's cup she'd tucked in her coupon drawer.
"Which one?" he said.
"The one where you can only eat what the dinosaurs ate."
"Didn't they all die off?" she laughed.
"That's why I like you, Luke."
"Why?"
"Because you're honest," she said. "Because you don't say, 'Oh, Cherry, you don't need to go on a diet.' What bullshit. The people who tell you that are the same ones calling you a fat ass once you leave the room."
He liked that she thought of him like that. Honest, shrewd, unsentimental. He found himself spending more time around her, even though he knew he shouldn't. He wasn't used to having friends with wives, but he understood that there were boundaries you ought to respect. And even though he knew he shouldn't visit when Finch wasn't home, he still swung by the house sometimes before his afternoon shift. He usually made up some excuse. He wanted to return a socket wrench Finch had lent him. He lost his playbook. He thought he'd left his water bottle on the coffee table. In reality, he just wanted to talk to Cherry, who always seemed interested in his life. She told him where he should look for a better-paying job, how he should consider going back to school, how he should stop stalking Nadia's Facebook.
"That's your first mistake," she said. "You never go sniffing around an ex. Why would you want to see how happy she is without you?"
Cherry was right. She was right about many things, and he liked asking her for advice. He couldn't ask his own mother, not anymore, not since the morning he'd told her about the pregnancy, and she'd returned with cash. He didn't blame her for helping him, but he knew something had shifted between them in that moment. His mother had done something he'd thought her incapable of, and the boundaries of their relationship had suddenly moved, leaving him disoriented, like stepping into a room and feeling for where the walls had once been, but instead only touching air.
"What are you two hens jabbering about?"
Finch said when he came into the kitchen and caught them in mid-conversation. Cherry always said nothing and went back to being her silent self. It amazed Luke how quickly she could shift. Maybe all women were shapeshifters, changing instantly depending on who was around. Who was Nadia then around Shadi Waleed?
"I saw your video," Cherry said one day when Luke came by to return a book he'd borrowed called Blues Hanging.
"Here," she'd said, handing it to him. "Here's your poor Hawaiians." He'd almost told her that he didn't have to read about it to believe her, but he read the book anyway because he could tell it mattered to her. He liked it enough, even though he'd read online that the treatment of Filipino characters might be a little racist. Was that true? He'd planned to ask her. Was it true that in Hawaii, Filipinos are treated like blacks?
"What video?" he said, half listening as he tried to find the spot on the shelf where the book had been.
"What do you mean?" she said. "What other video is there?"
"Oh," he said, "that one."
"Finch had some of the guys over," she said. "They kept watching it again and again and again." He had a sudden, clear image of the cobras hunched around Finch's computer, replaying the video of his injury and laughing.
"Jesus Christ, look at Shepard. One more time, okay? Wait for it. Wait for... Oh, shit! The bone and everything!"
He'd thought he was a cobra, but he wasn't. He was just a gruesome joke.
"Can I see it?" Cherry asked.
"You already did," he said.
He felt strangely betrayed by her, as if she, of all people, should have known better than to watch the video.
"No," she said. "Your leg."
She'd spoken so casually, it took him a moment to even realize what she'd asked.
"Why?"
he said.
"Just want to," she said. "I can't even understand how you walk on that thing half normal, let alone play."
She was curious, but not like he'd imagined the cobras searching for a laugh. She looked like a person climbing out of a wrecked car, eager to inspect the damage to convince herself it wasn't worse than what she imagined. He sat on the lazy boy near the bookshelf, quietly rolling the leg of his sweatpants up to his knee. His mother had cried when she'd seen him in the hospital bed, his shattered leg propped up in front of him, and not wanting to worry her, he had smiled and said,
"It's fine. It don't even hurt."
His father had called later that afternoon from Atlanta. He was delivering a keynote address at a pastor's conference that night, but he'd sent a prayer cloth in his stead. When his mother had placed it on his busted leg, Luke hadn't felt the healing power of God. He'd felt nothing, and maybe that was the same thing. He shivered as Cherry's hand traced down his leg to the ugly brown scar stretching down to his ankle. She bent and kissed his scar, and he closed his eyes, believing, like a child, that her kiss might stop his hurting. How easily he had believed then, how simple it had seemed. A kiss from his mother, and a body that always, somehow, healed. The next evening, he hauled the trash out to the alley behind Fat Charlie's, still thinking about Cherry's kiss. He had left right after. Her youngest daughter had appeared in the hallway, demanding juice, and Cherry had pushed herself to her feet, not looking at Luke. She was embarrassed, and why wouldn't she be? She was spare with her affection, even to Finch, as if the two were in a competition, fighting to be the one who seemed to care the least. But Luke was grateful for her kindness. He wanted to call her when he got off work. Maybe he could ask her to get a drink. Not a drink, maybe coffee. He didn't even like coffee, but coffee seemed like the thing you invited a girl to do to show that you weren't just trying to fuck her. He dragged a bulging garbage bag, lugging it into the green dumpster. The sun was setting over the pier, the sky blazing orange. Sometimes Oceanside could be beautiful, even from a dirty alley. He was heading back inside when he saw the Cobras, Finch and Ritter and Gorman and five others, all coming down the alley.
"Yo, assholes," he said. "I can't get all of you free beer, so don't even ask."
He knew something was wrong when no one laughed or insulted him back. Years ago, Luke would have been fast enough to duck inside the restaurant. But before he could even turn, he caught Finch's right hook. He blacked out before the Cobras started stomping on his leg. Chapter 7. In rehab, Luke learned to walk again. Not all at once, but slowly. He spent his first 2 weeks pushing a walker down the four halls of his floor. He learned the halls intimately, like a policeman memorizing his beat. The mint-green checkered linoleum, the nurse's station, the corner where old women knitted and gossiped. He dragged himself down the halls, stunned each morning by how difficult a simple action could be, the placing of one foot in front of the other. He now had a titanium rod screwed in his leg, from his knee to his ankle, which would remain there for the rest of his life. He would set off plenty of metal detectors, the surgeon had told him, but someday he'd be able to walk again. For now, he had to work on strengthening his ankle, bending his swollen knee, developing his quad and hamstring. He slid his foot forward, straining to place the heel down, then the toe, while his rehabilitation aide, Carlos, followed, just in case he fell. Carlos's father was Colombian, his mother Nicaraguan, but everyone called him a Mexican.
"Always a Mexican," he said. "They ask me, 'Hey, Carlos, why don't you fix us some tacos?' I don't know nothing about no fucking tacos. Go fix me some tacos. You like the goddamn thing so much."
It was true. When Luke had first checked in, a nurse told him that the aide assigned to him was Carlos, the Mexican guy.
"You'll like him," she said. "He's real funny. Little guy, but he's strong. Those are always the strongest ones, the little guys."
Carlos was barely 5'5", broad-shouldered and stout. He used to be a personal trainer at a gym. Luke had always thought of trainers as yoked men with muscles bulging out of their tank tops. But Carlos looked more like the type you might trust if you were a fat housewife looking to lose a few pounds. He was tough, but encouraging. He lectured Luke about taking his pills, all of them, even if he didn't feel like it. The antibiotics to prevent infection, the aspirin to stop blood clotting, the pain medicine. He helped Luke stretch on the table, massaging his leg first with aloe vera lotion. Luke was used to trainers rubbing down sore muscles, easing out cramps, or taping sprained ankles.
But that was in the locker room. He felt awkward, splayed on a table in an exercise room, another man rubbing lotion onto his skin. Maybe Carlos was gay. Why else would a guy take a job where he had to lotion other guys? But Luke never said anything because Carlos's massages felt good. The tissue damage went deep.
Christ, those guys really hated your guts, Carlos said. They didn't want you to ever walk again.
Luke had never told his parents that the cobras had jumped him. It'd be one thing if he had slept with Cherry. He would have accepted his punishment then like a man. But to be jumped for seeking her friendship seemed too shameful to admit. Besides, his parents would only tell him that they had been right about the team all along, so he'd told them that some guys had tried to mug him, and no, he hadn't seen their faces. On the overhead television, Carlos played football matches while Luke did his daily exercises. Panting, leaning against the wall, Luke followed the tiny ball across the ocean of grass. He'd always found soccer boring, but he grew to like the nonstop pace, the constant movement, the flashy celebrations. Maybe he would have been good at soccer. Maybe he could have found a sport to love that wouldn't have destroyed his body.
You used to be a big man, Carlos said. You ain't anymore. Gotta accept that. It's okay to not be a big man. It's enough to be a good one.
It didn't matter who you'd been out in the world. In rehab, you were just like everyone else, struggling to gain control of your body. Luke was the youngest person in the center. Most of the patients were elderly. In wheelchairs, they scooted down the hall with their feet, like children who'd outgrown their strollers. Between therapy sessions, Luke liked to sit in the hallway and play cards with the old men. Stroke victims, most of them. His favorite was Bill, a retired jailer from Los Angeles.
I grew up in Ladera Heights, Bill told him, back when it used to be black. You can't even go in there now. Got taken over by all those.
He dropped his voice, pointing at Carlos walking down the hall. Mexicans. Bill had fought in the Korean War, but he'd ended up at the rehab center after tripping on the sidewalk and breaking his hip. The man had survived war and prisoner riots, only to be brought down by upraised pavement. He wasn't married. He had been 3 times before, so he was the marrying type, just not the stay married type. He'd always been a ladies' man. Luke spotted him flirting with the nurses, holding their hands as they wheeled him down the hall, sweet-talking them for an extra cookie after dinner. Luke used to think he might be that type of man, the kind who never settled down. But what good did that do you when you were 80 and alone at a rehab center?
You sweet on anyone?
Bill asked him once.
Big football guy. I know the girls got to be chasing you.
Luke shrugged, reshuffling the deck of cards. He'd thought about calling Nadia once or twice, but what would he say? That the only thing he did every day was learn to walk? How simple exercises like knee lifts or leg curls made him groan? How he spent hours in a wheelchair playing poker with old men to pass the time? One evening, he was in the middle of dealing out another hand when the elevator doors opened and out stepped Aubrey Evans.
Hi, she said. The mothers asked me to drop this off.
She held up a knitted blanket, a bundle of pink and green and silver that was startlingly bright against the white walls. He led Aubrey to his room. She didn't say anything as he pushed his walker slowly down the hall, staggering with each step. He collapsed on his bed,
embarrassed by how winded he was. Aubrey folded the blanket neatly and set it on the end of his bed. He'd never been alone with her before. He knew her from church, vaguely. She seemed nice and religious in a way that had always bored him. But people seemed to like her. His mother, Nadia, according to all the pictures he'd seen of them together on Facebook.
"I didn't know you were still in town," he said.
"I'm taking classes," she said, "at Palomar, and working."
"Where?"
"Donut touch."
She frowned when he snorted.
"What?"
"Nothing," he said. "It's just a dumb name."
She smiled. "If you really wanted a donut, you wouldn't care what it's called." He couldn't remember the last time he'd eaten a donut. Even before he'd existed on plastic hospital food, he had converted back to a football diet. Good, clean eating. Grilled chicken and vegetables at every meal. A lot of good that had done him. He pushed himself to his feet, holding on to the walker for balance.
"Do you still talk to Nadia Turner?"
he asked. "All the time," she said.
"Is she still in Russia?"
"What?" Aubrey laughed, her nose scrunching up. "She was never in Russia."
"Really?"
"England. France for a little bit." She paused. "Wanna see pictures?"
He did, but he shook his head, staring at the floor.
"Nah," he said. "I just never knew anyone who went to Russia."
"Me either," Aubrey said. "But she goes everywhere. Anywhere she wants to be, she goes."
He felt stupid for the time he'd spent imagining Nadia in Russia, wearing furry hats in front of colorful buildings shaped like tops. But if anyone he knew went, it would be her. How had he ever thought she would stay in town with him and raise their baby? Aubrey dug in her purse for her keys. She was leaving, and he felt a sudden need to stop her.
"We pray for you every Sunday," she said. "Let me know if you need anything."
"You could bring me a donut," he said.
The next day, Aubrey brought him a red velvet donut, moist and sweet enough he could forgive the stupid name. Other things she later brought him, a new deck of playing cards, chewing gum, a book called Why Do Christians Suffer that he didn't read but kept on the nightstand so she'd see it when she visited, a daily planner where he could keep track of his progress, a bundle of Get Well cards from Upper Room, and a tank top that said Beast Mode that he wore during his exercises. She was pretty in a quiet way he grew to like. Nadia's beauty bulldozed him, but Aubrey's prettiness was like a tea candle, a warm flicker. When she visited him after work, she looked cute in her uniform, a black polo shirt with a pink donut on the front. She fiddled with the matching visor as she stepped off the elevator, her curly ponytail bobbing. She smelled sweet, like frosting.
"I used to have one of those joints,"
he said once, pointing at her purity ring.
"Really?"
"I was like 13, but my hand outgrew it, so my dad had to saw it off me."
"You're joking."
He held up his hand. On his right ring finger, a light brown scar.
"It's okay," he said. "I ended up fucking a girl later that year. I would have done it anyway. The ring just would have made me feel bad."
"It's not about feeling bad," she said. "At least not for me."
"Then what is it? Like a married to Jesus thing?"
"It just reminds me."
"Of what?"
"That I can be clean," she said.
She was a good woman. The more time he spent around her, the more he realized how rarely he thought anybody else was actually good. Nice, maybe, but
But niceness was something anyone could be, whether they meant it or not. But goodness was another thing altogether. He was wary at first, disarmed by Aubrey's kindness. What could she want from him? Everyone wanted something, but what could she possibly hope to gain from a man whose whole world had constricted to four hallways? Sometimes they played cards in his room, dipping their hands into a paper bag filled with donut holes. Other times, she wheeled him outside and they sat, watching cars come and go in the parking lot. He never asked her about Nadia, although he wanted to. He would feel exposed even mentioning her again. Besides, like Cherry said, why would he want to keep hearing how happy Nadia was? How big and exciting and fulfilling a life she led. He wasn't a big man anymore. He wouldn't be famous like he'd dreamed as a kid, teaching himself to sign his name in all curved letters so he would be prepared to autograph a football. He would live a small life, and instead of depressing him, the thought became comforting. For the first time, he no longer felt trapped. Instead, he felt safe. He taught Aubrey to play poker, then blackjack. She picked up both games surprisingly quickly, and he told her that they should go to Vegas someday and play in a real casino. She laughed. She'd never been before. "Why would I go to Vegas?" she said. "I don't party or gamble." "Because it's fun," he said. "There's food and shows. You like plays, don't you? We could go when I get out." She smiled a little, plucking a card from the middle of her hand. "Sure," she said. "That sounds good." She was just being nice, but he still clung to her words, marking them in his planner that night.
"What you gonna do when you get out of here?" Bill asked.
Luke had just graduated to crutches, and he was hobbling around the hallway, giddy and awkward. He'd progressed faster than anyone had expected, Carlos told him. He'd given Luke a tiny pedometer to wear when he walked down the hall, and within a month, he had already logged 50,000 steps. Carlos printed him a certificate that said, "MVP, Most Valuable Pacer." Aubrey helped him hang it on his wall.
"I don't know," he said.
Fat Charlie's didn't offer sick leave. They'd replaced him weeks ago. He needed to find a job, or he would have to move back home with his parents, who had already spent their own money paying for his last month at the rehab center. He hobbled down the hallway, calculating how much it must have cost, and felt overwhelmed by the thought of it. Just another thing he owed them. He would have to find work soon, maybe another restaurant on the pier. What else did he know how to do?
Nah, Bill said. "You got to want more than that."
Luke laughed.
"Like what? I'm supposed to want to be president or some shit?" "That's the problem with you brothers," Bill said. "You got lazy. You know why? Because you know these young sisters will pick up the slack. Grown men living with their mamas, whole mess of kids running around, ain't got a job. Somewhere along the way, we became a race of men happy to let women take care of us."
Luke had grown up listening to old folks at Upper Room make similar speeches about how they'd fought so hard just to watch his generation throw any progress away, as if he owed them somehow for being young and ought to personally repay them for their humiliations. Still, he liked hanging out with the old men in the hallway, listening to their stories and imagining their lives. Bill never listened to the trainers when they tried to guide him through his exercises. He was too stubborn, too softened over the years to pain. Who could blame him? He was old, with no one waiting for him on the outside.
He just wanted to talk shit with his buddies and look at pretty nurses. Luke was the only one who could get Bill out of his wheelchair.
"You're pretty good at this," Carlos told him.
Luke had convinced Bill to finish his quad stretches, cheering him on until the old man plopped back in his wheelchair with a huff. In the doorway, Carlos looked impressed.
"You should look into physical training," Carlos said. "Shit, you been here long enough."
Luke told Aubrey, and the next day, she printed out a list of qualifications he needed to become a physical therapy assistant. 2 years of school, which discouraged him, but Aubrey said the time would pass anyway. Why not spend it chasing after something he wanted? She'd squeezed his shoulder, and he felt himself relaxing. She was right, and besides, if he had learned nothing else in rehab, he'd learned how to be patient. He'd spent the past few months relearning how to walk. He felt that he could wait for anything. When he was finally released from the rehab center, strong enough to lean on a cane alone, time seemed to rush at him. He missed the soft seconds in the center, days that blurred into one another, time marked only by mealtimes and exercise routines and Aubrey's visits. Out in the world, he felt time racing past him and he could never catch up. In the center, he'd been a fast learner, nimble compared to the others. But at his parents' house, he felt like he was moving in slow motion, like every effort to get out of bed and shower, to dress himself and cook breakfast, took three times as long. During the day, he worked on his applications to physical therapy programs and tried to find a job. But he didn't have any real skills, and most unskilled jobs required that you at least be able to lift 50 pounds. Finally, he asked his father if there was any work he could do at Upper Room.
"Maybe I could do something around the grounds," he said. "Pick up trash? I don't know, something."
Luke felt embarrassed, begging for pocket change. But his father placed a warm hand on his shoulder and smiled. He had probably been waiting for this moment for years. When his only son would return home, humbled, and ask to help out the ministry. Maybe he'd imagined this moment when Luke was born, a son who would inherit the church someday. A son standing beside him at the altar, leading teen Bible studies, following him through the halls of Upper Room. How disappointed his father must have been, given instead a son who worshipped pigskin, who spent his Sunday praise in front of the television, who hadn't been called by God to do anything but run and catch.
"The church is growing," his father said, "getting older. We could use someone to visit the sick and shut-in."
"I can do that," Luke said.
He understood sickness better than anything else. Sickness burrowed deep inside you. And even if you were cured, even if you could be cured, you would never forget how it felt to be betrayed by your own body. So when he knocked on doors, carrying donated meals, he did not tell the sick to get well. He just came to sit with them while they weren't. He still saw Aubrey around Upper Room. He'd been worried at first that she wouldn't talk to him now that he was out of rehab, that maybe their friendship had been restricted to that space. But she always seemed glad to see him. She never came by the house, although he hinted that that would be okay. But on Sunday mornings, she sat beside him, not in the front pew where he'd sat with his parents as a boy, but in a back pew near the aisle so he could stretch out his bad leg. Each Sunday, when his father laid hands on the sick, she glanced at him
and each Sunday, he looked away, studying the fringes on the rug. One week, she leaned in toward his ear.
"Do you want to go up?" she asked. "I'll go with you."
How could anyone believe healing was that easy, only a matter of asking for it? What about those who remained sick? Did they just not ask hard enough? But she reached for his hand, her fingers wedged against his purity scar. Their palms kissed, and he felt, for the first time, that he could be whole. On a brisk May night, Luke pushed through the concession stand crowd with his plastic cup of overpriced stadium beer. CJ trampled after him, carrying a cup of beer that sloshed against his hand. He didn't like baseball, but he'd agree to the Padres game because they rarely hung out now that they no longer worked together. CJ had wanted to check out a football game. In the springtime, you could always find an arena game or even a spring practice. But Luke told him he wanted to watch baseball. He didn't really, but he couldn't put himself through more football. He'd already given football too much. He would find something new to love. During the seventh inning stretch, the crowd began to sing as an animated Friar Fred danced on the scoreboard. CJ moved his lips the way Luke mouthed along to church hymns. When they sat, CJ took a sip of his tepid beer before setting it back on the ground.
"I gotta get out of fucking Fat Charlie's, man," CJ said. "And do what?" "I don't know. Anything else. Maybe join up. Marines? Shit, maybe. What else I know how to do?"
He couldn't imagine CJ in camp or huffing through the desert with a gun strapped to his back. Could CJ even pass the fitness test? He was strong enough, sure, but you had to run 3 miles, and he had never seen CJ run 30 yards.
"What if they send you out somewhere?" Luke said.
CJ shrugged.
"At least it's something. I gotta be on my shit like you. You got a future. What I got?"
An old black vendor climbed the metal stairs hollering,
"Peanuts? Who wants a big bag of salty nuts?"
The crowd laughed, and Luke sipped his beer, wiping his mouth with a grease-splotched napkin. He wasn't used to anyone else envying his life. He lived at home and collected $50 each week from his father that felt more like an allowance than a paycheck. He leaned on a cane when he had to walk a long distance, and at the stadium, he'd been patted down and wanded 3 times after the metal rod in his leg had set off the detectors. But he was building something, at least. He was starting his physical therapy classes in the fall. He spent his weekends with a girl who calmed him, who pieced him together. A pretty brunette in a retro Tony Gwynn jersey passed, and he wondered if he could bring Aubrey to a game. She'd look cute in his cap, and maybe they'd get caught on the kiss cam, and she would lean toward him, not embarrassed by the cheers of the crowd. He would hope for the Padres to hit a home run just to see her face when fireworks shot across the sky. At the top of the eighth, a small black boy in an Angels jersey, 3 times too big for him, hopped on the seat, yelling for the cotton candy man. The vendor didn't notice, starting down the aluminum steps.
"Hey, man!"
Luke stood, wincing at the sudden movement.
"Right here!"
He pointed at the boy. The vendor stopped and the boy stumbled down the row, climbing over legs as he waved his dollars in the air. The man stooped with the carousel of pink and blue swathes of cotton candy, and the boy jumped, pointing to the baby blue. He wiggled impatiently as the vendor gave him his change. Then he smiled, triumphant, holding the cotton candy in his hands. Everyone ushered the boy down the row, hands against his back so he didn't trip. Luke's finger brushed against the smooth inside of his thin arm as he passed.
"Tell me a secret," Aubrey said later.
Luke stretched out on his bed. His room was warm from the late spring heat, but he couldn't open a window or Aubrey would be cold. She was always cold, and he liked that about her, how he felt responsible for warming her. She was curled against his chest, and he bent to kiss her forehead. His parents were gone for the evening, but he knew she hadn't come over to do more than cuddle. When they'd first started dating, he'd tried to find times to spend with her alone. He knew she was waiting to have sex, but she wouldn't want to wait forever. Just a matter of time, he figured, until she felt ready. But months later, they still hadn't had sex yet. Often, when Aubrey visited, they didn't even go near his bedroom, eating dinner with his parents instead, or sitting together on the porch swing. Maybe it was weird for her, hooking up in her pastor's house, so he started visiting her at her sister's house instead, even though he felt awkward in a house full of women. He stepped inside a bathroom with a counter covered in girly products, bottles of all shapes and sizes, moisturizers, facial cream, serum, leave-in conditioner, and washed his hands with pink soap that left his skin feeling soft and smelling like powder. It made him feel unmanly, so he started washing his hands with the orange dishwashing soap in the kitchen instead. No matter where they went, they didn't have sex. Kissing was fine, and sometimes touching was okay, but always over the clothes and always above the waist. He'd never dated a girl before who he hadn't seen naked, and he burned, imagining what it would be like to really touch her. When they spoke on the phone at night, he pictured her in bed, lying against the sheets in tiny shorts and a tank top with no bra. He touched himself sometimes as she talked about her day, thinking about how her nipples would look poking against white cotton. He always felt guilty afterward for defiling her image. Dirty. Under her thin t-shirt, he could make out the swell of her breasts, and he wanted to touch her, but he stopped himself. She wanted a secret. She was trying to be serious. He thought about mentioning the boy at the baseball game. He hadn't stopped thinking about the smoothness of the boy's skin, but that sounded creepy, even in his own head. She wouldn't understand. He barely understood it himself. "I got a girl pregnant once," he said. "She didn't keep it." Aubrey was quiet a minute.
"Who is she?"
she finally said.
"A girl I used to know,"
he said.
"I loved her, but she didn't want the baby."
"What happened to her? The girl, I mean."
"It was a long time ago," he said. "We haven't really talked since."
She reached for his hand. He felt relieved, even though he still couldn't bring himself to tell her the whole truth.
"Tell me something," he said. "Something you never told anyone."
She stared up at the ceiling. Then she said,
"When I was little, I used to think I had superpowers."
He laughed.
"What?"
"Super senses," she said. "Not powers, because they didn't make me feel stronger. But you know how in biology class, they used to talk about how animals adapt? Like how over time, fish at the bottom of the ocean started doing weird things like glowing in the dark so they can lure prey and survive? It was like that."
"What type of superpower?" he said.
"Like,
I could smell if a man was good or bad. Or I could jump out of my skin when he touched me.
Ooh.
And I could hear really good, she said. I could hear him moving throughout the apartment, like a rat clicking through the pipes. I could hear him before he got to my room, and I always wondered why my mom never heard, but I told myself she couldn't, because she didn't have super senses. She started to cry. His clumsy hands cupped her face, and he kissed her wet cheeks, her jaw, her forehead. He buried his face in her neck, wanting to keep her in her skin.
Chapter 8. We forgot about Nadia Turner, the way any unseen person is unthought of. She was a pretty unmothered girl who'd wrecked her daddy's truck and after she fell out of our minds. Except for the few moments she popped up, like when someone asked Robert Turner how his daughter was doing and he said fine, just fine, finishing up her sophomore year, or working an internship in Wisconsin this summer. Yeah, some government thing, who knows. Robert continued to lend his truck. The first lady did not hire another assistant. But we didn't see Nadia Turner again. Not Thanksgiving, not Christmas, not long patches of summer while we were sweating in our prayer room, cycling through cards filled with requests. In hot months, wanting always reaches its peak. Only years later, years after we heard the rumor, have we collected the signs. Betty says, weren't it peculiar that she'd never wanted to volunteer in the children's church room, not even when she was flitting and following Aubrey Evans around? Agnes, the most attuned to spiritual things, says she passed the girl in the church lobby once and saw a baby trailing behind her. A little boy in knee socks, and when Agnes glanced back, he was gone. Oh, I knew, she says, when we bring up Nadia Turner. I knew right away, just as soon as I seen her. I can always tell an unpregnant girl. After a secret's been told, everyone becomes a prophet. A winter, and then another, and then another. Soon, Nadia had been gone so long, she felt guilty about returning home at all. By senior year, she thought of Oceanside as a tiny beach setting trapped inside a snow globe. Occasionally, she might take it down from her bookshelf and gaze at it, but she could never fit inside. As graduation neared, she took the LSAT and applied to law school at NYU and Duke and Georgetown, any program that might keep her away from home, finally accepting an offer from the University of Chicago. She had planned to work throughout the summer in Ann Arbor, then move to Chicago in the upcoming fall. But home tugged her back in the form of a breathless phone call from Aubrey. Luke had proposed that night. They were getting married. She wanted Nadia to hear it first. What's the matter? Shoddy asked. When she hung up the phone, he perched on the edge of the couch. I thought she's your friend.
She is.
So why aren't you happy?
Because her fiancé's a dick.
Then why's she marrying him?
She doesn't know it.
A different man, a more perceptive one, might have asked how Nadia knew. But Shoddy just pushed off the couch and went to boil noodles for dinner. He didn't ask certain questions about her life before him because he didn't want to know the answers. She was happy to oblige him, avoiding any mention of the summer before college altogether. She couldn't tell him about Luke and the baby. Shoddy was a good, progressive boy,
But maybe he wouldn't understand why she'd gone to the abortion clinic. Maybe abortion seemed different when it was just an interesting topic to write a paper about or debate over drinks when you never imagined it might affect you. And since she couldn't tell him about the baby, she couldn't explain why she'd been so devastated when Aubrey visited 2 years ago and announced that she'd been spending time with Luke. At first, Nadia didn't even hear her. She was so excited to see her, she could hardly believe that Aubrey was actually here in the passenger's seat of Shadi's Corolla, which he'd graciously lent her so she could pick Aubrey up from Detroit Metro Airport. On the ride back to Ann Arbor, Nadia kept glancing at Aubrey and grinning, already imagining the dive bars she would bring her to, the frat parties that would make Cody Richardson's house seem as quiet and peaceful as a library. She would be introducing her college boyfriend and her college friends to her back-home friend, those two disparate parts of her life blending in a way that felt sophisticated and mature. Then she realized that Aubrey had mentioned Luke.
"What?" she'd said. "I said, me and Luke have been spending time together."
"What?" Nadia said again. "I know," Aubrey said. "Don't you think it's weird?"
"Why would it be weird?"
"I don't know. We just never really spent time together before. But now..." She'd trailed off cryptically. Spending time. What did that even mean? Fucking? No. Aubrey would have said something if she'd broken her virginity pledge, wouldn't she? So if they weren't having sex, what were they doing together? That had bothered Nadia the most. Luke courted Aubrey. He took her on trips to the zoo, where he'd bought nectar so they could feed the birds. Aubrey sent Nadia pictures of them posing in front of the birdcage, Luke dripping with tropical birds on his arms, or the two of them celebrating their first anniversary at Disneyland, Luke wearing a goofy baseball cap with dog ear flaps. Nadia couldn't imagine Luke ever wearing a cutesy hat in public, let alone planning a date that took more effort than sending a text message a few hours in advance. He was different now. Or maybe he was different with someone other than her. She'd never thought their relationship would last. How could it? What could they possibly have in common? What could possibly bind them together? Instead, she'd scrolled incessantly past photographs of the two of them sitting together on the edge of a dock, or sharing dinner downtown, or posing in the kitchen with Pastor and Mrs. Shepherd on Thanksgiving. Mrs. Shepherd beaming, an arm around Aubrey's waist, as if she had actually selected her perfect daughter-in-law years ago. She must have felt relieved that Luke had finally realized it.
"So, are you going?" Shadi asked. "To the wedding?"
"I guess I have to," she said.
"I can always go with you," he said.
She heard the smile in his voice, even though his back was to her. He hinted about this often, visiting home with her and meeting her father. Their friends teased them about marriage, but she always avoided the topic of a deeper commitment. Besides, his mother liked her, but she wanted Shadi to marry a Muslim girl.
"Okay," Nadia said when he'd announced it. "What do you expect me to do about that?"
"Nothing," he said. "I just think it's funny."
"My dad wants me to marry a Christian boy," she said. "It matters to some people."
She felt annoyed by the way Shadi hinted about the future. He'd just received a job offer from Google, but he'd mentioned once, almost slyly, that if she wanted to move back to California after graduation, he could transfer to the Mountain View office.
She'd laughed at his underestimation of the expansiveness of California. Didn't he know that Mountain View was an 8-hour drive from San Diego? Still, it scared her, his willingness to pick up his life and follow her. She'd fallen for him when he wanted to become an international reporter, flying on choppers into war-torn countries. His independence liberated her. But now he was going to work in an office, and she felt crushed already by his hopes for her. As graduation approached, she found herself picking fights with him more, like when she told him she didn't plan to walk at commencement. Shoddy told her she was being selfish. "Graduation's not about you," he said. "It's about everyone who cares about you. Don't you think your dad wants to see you walk?"
"Don't you think it's none of your fucking business?" she said.
She didn't want to walk if her mother couldn't be there to watch her. Her mother had never gone to college, but said she would someday. Always someday. When the Palomar College catalog came in the mail, she would lean against the countertop, scanning the bold titles of courses she would never take. Once, Nadia's father had thrown out the catalog with the rest of the junk mail, and her mother had almost rooted through the trash can for it before her father said he'd already taken it to the dumpster.
"I thought it was trash," he'd said.
"No, Robert, no," her mother said. "No, it's not trash."
She'd seemed desperate, like she'd lost more than a catalog that arrived in their mailbox every 6 months. By then, her mother was too busy with work and family to return to school, but she'd always told Nadia that she expected her to go to college. She reminded her of this when she checked over her math homework or chided her for her sloppy handwriting or quizzed her on reading assignments. Nadia knew she was the reason her mother had never gone to college, and she'd wondered if, after she left home, her mother might finally go. Now graduation seemed silly. Why should she dress in a cap and gown and sweat in the sun when her mother was not there to pose in pictures with her and cheer when her name was called? In her mind, she only saw pictures they would never take, arms around each other, her mother gaining little wrinkles around her eyes from smiling so much. Nadia apologized to Shoddy that night. She slipped inside his bed naked, and he groaned, rolling toward her, stiff before she even touched him. She tasted the salt off his skin, the ticklish spot on his neck, as he fumbled in the nightstand drawer. She was on the pill, but she always made him wear a condom, too.
"What are you thinking about?" he asked after.
"I hate when you do that," she said.
"Do what?"
"Ask what I'm thinking. As soon as you ask, my mind just goes blank."
"It's not a test," he said. "I just want to know you."
Later in the night, she shrugged his arm off her. She felt sweaty with him hugging her all night. Sometimes, she wondered if she only loved him when it was cold, in the middle of winter, when everything was dead. Aubrey Evans' entire life boiled down to the places she'd slept. Her girlhood bed with its pink princess headboard, pull-out couches in relatives' living rooms when her father left, the back seat of her mother's car when hospitality ran out, the trundle of Moe's daybed when they'd moved into a new apartment, her mother's bed because she hated to sleep alone, her own bed after her mother's boyfriend moved in, her own bed where her mother's boyfriend touched her, the bed in her sister's guest room where she'd escaped, and now Luke's bed, where they had never made love. His non-making love bed was her favorite. The department store normalcy of his blue plaid bedspread, always a little must,
as if it had just been sat on. There wasn't much else in his studio apartment. A wicker basket from his mother, now filled with free weights, a crumpled pizza box jutting out of the trash can, Nikes lined up near the door, wooden cane propped against the wall. The first time she'd visited him in his apartment, she'd frozen in his doorway, unsure of what to do. They had never been this alone before, in a place that belonged to no one else, where no one else had a key and might interrupt. Luke had gestured toward his bed.
"Sorry," he'd said. "There's nowhere else to sit."
So they'd sat on his bed and watched a movie. Other things they did in his bed, ate pizza on paper plates, played cards, played Madden with the injuries setting turned off, watched the Super Bowl, listened to music from her tinny laptop speakers, held hands, kissed, argued, and prayed. They had slept together, as in beside each other. She'd fallen asleep on pillows, smelling faintly of his cologne, and he'd curled against her.